All right, welcome in, folks. I am going to quickly introduce Rick Brown, and I'll do this now so that he will have the full hour to do his session. So, as founder and president of Terra Verde Energy from 2009 to 2020, Rick has led a team that has developed over $500 million in clean energy projects in over 350 buildings on behalf of schools, cities, transit agencies, and water districts, primarily serving low-income communities throughout California. He has also been deeply involved in California legislation and regulation regarding clean energy and has been called on by the California Public Utilities Commission. California Energy Commission and legislature to provide expert testimony on a wide range of clean energy issues. He is an executive committee member of the School Energy Coalition, the policy committee chair of the Building Decarbonization Coalition. These are like really big words. Policy committee chair and senior advisor with the Climate Center. Previously, in 2006, he successfully helped launch MMA Renewable Ventures, one of the first providers of tax equity financing for solar. And yet, there's more. Very accomplished. Prior to his career in clean energy, Dr. Brown provided consultation to a wide range of public, private, and nonprofit companies and organizations on strategy, governance, leadership, public outreach, participation, and human resource management. Rick, his wife, Tracy Greenwald, and his two daughters, Emily and Laura, have been coming to Holden Village over the past 30 years. In 2019, he provided consultation to the Holden Board for its development of a long-term strategic plan, and he joined the board in 2020 and now serves on its Finance Committee and Hydro Task Force. So let's give a hearty welcome to Rick.
Thank you, Amber Kate, that's great. So this is a 5-session course. I've never taught it before. I'm not typically a teacher. I'm a consultant, I'm a business person, I do advocacy. I don't generally do teaching, so I will beg your forbearance if I sort of wander into things that don't make sense. But I would like to have feedback. Because I hope to do this kind of a thing more and more, do this kind of educational process. So feedback during, after, so forth would be great. The other part is that I have a lot of content here, and I can get very focused on the content, but I really would like to have reactions, questions, comments all throughout the session. Feel free to just interrupt, raise your hand, whatever. I'd like this to be as interactive as possible. So, the sessions, I'm going to just do a quick overview of the 5 sessions. The first is, what I'm calling the climate emergency or climate imperative. I'm going to do a little bit of introduction to how I got into this work because I think it's important in terms of one of my goals is that some of you, or hopefully all of you, will come away from this thinking about how you can make this part of your work, your life, in many ways. So hopefully I can provide some context for that. And then a lot of this is really about giving you information on why we need to take significant action on climate as soon as possible, meaning like right now. The second session, Clean Energy, Don't Call Me Alternative, is going to be about the fundamentals of clean energy technology, policy, and politics, and how, in fact, clean energy, solar, wind, et cetera, has become the incumbent lowest cost and most reliable energy source. It's not the alternative, it's the mainstream. It's that other stuff that we don't like so much, the fossil fuel-based energy that needs to be eliminated no later than 2030. That's the negative alternative. The third session is going to be on what I call the 3Ds, although there's some secret 2Ds that I'm going to add to it, so it's going to be 5Ds. But decarbonization, distribution, and democratization. This is going to be a review of the key roles that decarbonization of both energy, transportation, and the building sectors through implementation of distributed energy resources and democratization of energy policy play a critical role in the rapid reduction of greenhouse gases and a more vibrant and healthy and hopefully a more equitable economy. Session four is going to dive into clean energy politics and policy. The short description is think global, but act global too. Like the COVID pandemic, the climate crisis has taught us that we are all connected and that any kind of solutions that need to come about are going to have to be ones where we are all connected, and those strategies have to take place from both the local, national, and international levels. And then finally, the last session, I actually haven't done anything to prepare for. And this is really because this is going to be more about you and what you can be doing to take action. Based on the information, based on the dialogue we have, things that you might want to take back home with you around taking action. I actually do have some stuff, but anyway, it's not as formed. I'm hoping to kind of form it based on some of what I learned from you all over the next few days. So, as I said, by the end of the session, my hope is that you have a significantly deeper understanding of the need for immediate action in addressing the climate emergency, that you recognize that such action will require fundamental and likely disruptive changes in how we lead our lives, individually, in our local communities, in politics, business, and the world at large. And then you'll come away more knowledgeable about the many positive, life-affirming ways that this can be accomplished, leading to a world that is not just healed, but more whole, healthy, just, and connected. So that's an ambitious goal, but hopefully we can get there. So let's dive in. A little bit about my story. As Emmer Kate said, most of my early career was as an organizational strategy consultant, actually initially started as a community organizer, working around health and mental health issues at the grassroots level, then got my doctorate in organizational psychology and broadened my practice to other issues besides just healthcare, education, transportation, the environment, and so forth, primarily working with, as she said, nonprofits and public agencies, in some cases businesses that were focused on social benefit kinds of outcomes like low-income housing and so forth. In 2004, I was engaged by a national environmental organization called Earth Justice. Has anybody heard of Earth Justice? They have a great tagline, "Every planet needs a good lawyer." And Earth Justice engaged me to help them with a strategic planning process with a particular focus on how to put more attention to climate. They were organized at that time around clean air, clean water, endangered species, public lands, but they didn't really have a climate strategy. So this was an effort to put together a more comprehensive climate strategy. And in the process of digging into the information and working with, you know, lawyers from across the country on these issues, I kind of got religion around climate change, came to realize for me that this was the critical issue that I needed to be working on for the rest of my career. At the same time, I was had been working with an organization that was focused on the development of low-income housing, low-income affordable housing, through something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. Has anybody heard of that, LIHTC? Yeah, it's pretty much the primary way that low-income housing in this country is financed. So they were one of the, you know, I've been working with them for 3 or 4 years. We had grown their business to be one of the largest syndicators of low-income housing finance, meaning they got various banks and insurance companies and so forth to invest in low-income housing through tax credit instruments. And so that when in 2005, the federal government passed, and again, this was led by President George Bush, an old-type Republican, And you'll hear about another old-type Republican later who was very significant in the clean energy revolution. They passed something called the Investment Tax Credit for Solar, which essentially created an incentive for financing of solar. And it was a key, and we'll talk later on, a key piece of legislation in moving forward with clean energy as a possibility to become the major source of energy for this country, which has been critical to both past and future efforts to deal with climate change. In the process of working with both that company and with Justice, I came to the thought, hey, this company that does low-income housing tax credits, maybe they should get into solar tax credit. And so I went, was engaged to find some solar people. I lived in California. They were based in Baltimore, more solar people in California at that time. And we put together a company, and it was called MMA Renewable Ventures. And it was really the first and largest syndicator of investment tax credits for solar. But part of the deal was, if we're going to start this company, Rick, you have to come inside. You have to leave your consulting practice and come in. And they hired me as their executive vice president for corporate strategy, which involves starting up this company and a low-income housing company in South Africa, which has a great Holden connection at some point if we want to talk about it. So we launched that company, and it took off great guns, and we did the first major financing through a third party. Wells Fargo Bank invested $100 million. That was the most money that had ever been invested in solar at the time in 2007. We did the largest solar project in the country at the time in 2007 at an Air Force base. What can I tell you? And it was going great, and then what happened on September 15th, 2008? Right, the meltdown, the financial meltdown in the housing finance world. Parent company was whacked. They had $1 billion in forward commitments, meaning they had promised to finance, and Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, everybody pulled their lines of credit that day. The housing meltdown occurred, and so the parent company had to stay out of bankruptcy, had to sell its valuable assets, and so I started a company. 3 years later, I had to sell the company. So we had to sell MMA Renewable Ventures in 2009 to keep the parent company solvent. And I could have stayed and continued working for that company, but in the process of working at that company, I'd come to see that the sort of relationship, particularly between the developers of solar and the customers, in this case, the area that I cared a lot about, schools, that it was an uneven playing field, and that schools were often paying way more for their solar projects than they needed to because it was a new area, they didn't really know much about it. And so I started Terra Verde Energy at my kitchen table, the proverbial, kitchen table. 2009 was not the smartest time to start a company. We were in the middle of the recession. But it worked out, and over the next 12 years, built up that company to serve as the expert consultant for schools, cities, other public agencies, nonprofits, and so forth, and other kinds of entities that were trying to advance clean energy. Part of the thesis also was in working with schools is that in California, we have something called CalPERS, which is the California Public Employee Retirement System, and it's the second largest asset owner in the country in terms of financial assets investments. They are now at about $400 billion. And my thesis was that if I could make solar look like a good asset to invest in at schools, CalPERS, which provides retirement and health benefits for all of the non-teacher school employees in California, that they would be interested in investing. And part of the thesis here was where the money flows, policy will flow, change will flow. And it kind of worked out. But anyway, that was the Terra Verde story. I retired 2 years ago, but I'm still chair of the board of the company, and we've expanded into other areas that we can talk about a little bit later in terms of using business models. The basic thesis was using business models to advance policy. That's the change, the theory of change that I personally fit for me in terms of who I was. Part of what I'm interested in helping people explore is what theory of change or what process of change fits who you are and how you might want to do stuff around climate or clean energy stuff. So anyway, that's my story. So to get started, I just want to ask in groups of three, turn to two people next to you and briefly talk about, introduce yourself by sharing one way that you think climate change is impacting you and your community today, and one way you think it will impact you and your community by 2030. I'll give you about 6-7 minutes to sort of share that, answer that question, and then we'll get into more of your story. Okay, can I have everybody's attention? Thanks. So just some quick thoughts. What are some of the things that people talked about as how it's impacting your community today?
Wildfire smoke.
Wildfire smoke. Yep. Yeah.
Higher temperatures.
Temps, yep.
Less snowfall.
Less. Sorry?
Drought.
Drought.
Or increased deaths in the cities due to not enough cooling spaces.
Extreme heat.
Lower water supply.
Sorry about that. Anything else? So, what are the things that came up for 2030?
Worse.
All these worse. What else?
Water.
What about water?
It's the bad, actually the bad with it, the scarcity of water, and who's going to have water and who's not, and what's the result then of migration?
Okay, thank you. Waiting for that one. Climate refugees will be the.
Yeah.
Not that we don't already have them, but yeah.
Well, it's already impacting our younger generation.
Yeah.
Emotionally, as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Deciding not to have children.
Or... Right.
Decline in species.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is happening today, but it's going to accelerate. Yes. Yeah,
it's an international relations issue.
Yeah, connected to the climate refugee issue for sure. Geopolitical impacts, yeah.
The inequities and who gets the scarce resources.
Yeah, so this group is obviously very aware of what some of those impacts are today and where they're be will it be. I'm gonna, you know, this part of the session, I'm gonna have to figure out when I do this with other audiences, you know, where am I starting from? Because it really is, there's a wide range of knowledge. But one of the memes that one of the stories that's being told here, and this is how I like to give a shorthand for it, is nature is at bat today, not humans. I'm a baseball fan, so that's why I like that. But a lot of this stuff is about things that really are outside of, or seem to be outside of human control, that nature is exerting her influence. You probably heard this, I'm gonna just repeat it, but the sort of gold standard on research around climate change is the UN's International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. One of many acronyms I'll be using. And the way they said it in August, their latest report, was that climate change will fundamentally reshape life on Earth in the coming decades, even if humans contain planet-warming greenhouse gases. Species extinction, more widespread disease, unlivable heat, ecosystem collapse, cities menaced by rising seas. Nobody seemed to mention this. A lot of people are here or live, don't live on the coast, except for our Houston person, but yeah. Okay, yeah. Those of us who live on the coast are very aware of that one. These and other devastating climate impacts are accelerating, bound to become painfully obvious before a child born today turns 30. The choices societies make now will determine whether our species thrives or simply survives as the 21st century unfolds. This is a pretty grim statement, and yet, just as Jessica was talking the other day about how, you know, there's this, you know, awareness now, sort of the discovery doctrine, but, oh well, you know, let's move on. Unfortunately, there is that same kind of head in the sand, or avoidance, or denial, to a large extent, still around, you know, life on Earth is going to be fundamentally different even if we tame planet warming greenhouse gas emissions. That's the main message I want to kind of get out here is that, and I'll be talking about different people who frame this in different ways, we have to start getting ready and thinking in terms of we can't change the fact that things are going to get really different. We can do something to make it so that it won't get to a point where we can't survive. We can survive, but it is going to get really different. And you know, this summer, I think, has been more of a wake-up call in that respect for a lot of people because there have been just so many. It's not like a report from a scientist talking about, you know, 3 degrees of this and that. It's, I'm breathing wildfire smoke for 2 months. Right, I'm in a situation where my town, which never gets above 85 degrees, is at 115 degrees for 5 or 6 days, and there's no air conditioning. I mean, people are starting to have that visceral, real life experience. So hopefully, that awareness is going to come, and because we, without that awareness, we're not going to get the action we need. I'm going to just throw a bunch of other facts at you real quick, and then we'll talk some more. So. Let's talk about sort of the basics. Three important greenhouse gases are
carbon dioxide,
methane, and
sulfur dioxide.
Close. Nitrous oxide. Okay. All of them set year-to-date records for atmospheric concentration in both 2020 and 2021. In 2021, in April, carbon dioxide concentration reached 416 parts per million. Remember Bill McKibben's 350 organization? 350 was sort of the level we're not supposed to go over. The highest monthly global average concentration ever recorded. 2020 was the second hottest year on record, and all five of the hottest years on record have occurred since 2015. Again, we all kind of know this, but there's still a huge amount of, well, maybe we can figure things out and we'll kind of, you know, work it out. My message here is there's going to be significant disruptive change that we're going to have to act on. And while the impacts on humans is the primary concern, this is also a justice issue. There's a recent study that looked at the response of FEMA to climate disasters and how money was distributed. And on a consistent basis, white homeowners got more money than black homeowners in FEMA's response. Now, a lot of that has to do with the fact that the homes that white people lived in were, quote unquote, more valuable. Well, more valuable to who, right? If your home's your home. So literally, they gave an example in this study of a homeowner two blocks away, a white homeowner who got $17,000 from FEMA for the exact same damage that a black homeowner two blocks away got $7,000. So in this disaster is not just a disaster in terms of the ecosystem and so forth. It's also potentially contributing to even greater inequality and inequity than what already exists. Another interesting factoid is that this chart sort of illustrates, you can't read it, I'm sorry, but think about just the colors and the size over time. The number of climate disaster or climate emergency declarations has exponentially increased just since 2017. As Obama's planner for the National Security Council around climate stated, disasters cascading around the country this summer have exposed a harsh reality. The United States is not ready for the extreme weather that is now becoming frequent as a result of a warming planet. These events tell us we are not prepared. We've built our cities, our communities, for a climate that no longer exists. What you're hearing more and more from scientists who have been, at least 2-3 years ago, were still, do you believe in climate change or do you not believe in climate change? I mean, what? 11,000 scientists this year from 153 countries put together graphs of the planet's vital signs and basically said, we need to warn humanity that it is on a catastrophic path. I think you heard me the other day say, I started out calling this course, you know, climate strategy and then climate crisis, and now it's climate emergency, right? Because I think, you know, I was trying to soften it a little bit, and then I realized, why am I softening the words here? This is a emergency, right? It's Joe Biden said code red, you know? So it's happening. A few more factoids. I happened to find this picture of Montana and the Northwest, so I guess a lot of people here, you lived through this. You know what happened this summer. Until this summer, the focus was on floods, wildfires. If I had asked this question a year ago, I don't think I would have had the extreme heat message, but it's not that there haven't been extreme heat events, it's just they've been in places like Pakistan and Iran, you know, far away. When it hits Portland, Seattle, BC, you know, we have a different reaction. A recent study also reported that more than a third of the heat deaths in this country are now a direct effect of climate change. So, one more factoid that I just thought is really interesting. The core mission of the National Park Service has been about conservation for many years, right? And so how to preserve iconic landscapes unchanged is part of the founding documents of the National Park Service. But with climate change, park managers are now having to ask themselves questions that they've never had to ask before, which is, which species, which landscape are we going to try to save, and which are we going to let vanish? Because they don't have control over that. And this is the kind of hard choice that we're all going to be having to make. So, it gets better. It gets better. One more. Up until the last few years, the news and social media's primary storyline on climate has been whether, again, this or that political leader or celebrity didn't believe in climate change. He said this, she said that. On the one hand, some people say, but the good news is that with the increasing frequency of extreme climate events, most major news outlets now have actually a climate desk. I mean, when I started working on this 15, 16 years ago, there maybe was somebody who had an environmental writer, you know, but there was nobody who really was dedicated to climate. And really in the last 3 or 4 years, Washington Post, New York Times, various other outlets, CNN, they actually have somebody who is focused on climate. So that's a good news. The problem is the storyline is only marginally better. The focus is on the latest climate disaster, right? What we call climate porn. Because this goes along with the, you know, new, old newspaper adage, if it bleeds, It leads, right? That's how you spell papers. That's how you get eyeballs. So we still have a ways to go around reporting. But I think it's important we confront the reality that we are in an existential climate emergency and that we must face up the possibility that human civilization as we know it is at risk of being fundamentally changed for the worse if we don't act. Again, as the IPCC put it, the choices societies make now will determine whether our species thrives or simply survives as the 21st century unfolds. Okay, I'm going to get personal again for a second. So this is a picture of the Brown and Schaefer family Seder in 1929. What does that have to do with climate change? This is my family. This is my dad. He's 13 years old in this picture. And they're gathered around the Passover Seder table for a picture. And one of the rituals, I don't know if anybody's done this, but in the Passover Seder, is that we spill a drop of wine for each of the 10 plagues that the Egyptians suffered as Moses tried to convince Pharaoh that there was climate change. I mean, that Pharaoh, that he needed to let my people go, right? And each time Pharaoh would say, yeah, and then he would turn back and we'd have to do another plague. God did another plague. And so as we rejoice, but another part of that ceremony, why do we spill wine for each of the 10 plagues at the Passover Seder? And basically the idea is that as we rejoice around our deliverance and acknowledge that our freedom was hard-earned from slavery, we regret that our freedom came at the cost of the Egyptian suffering for all the human beings made in the image of God. And so we pour out wine to reduce our pleasure as part of that repentance for the plagues as we recite them. And here are those plagues. And why 10 plagues? The Egyptians needed 10 plagues because after each one, they were able to come up with all kinds of justifications and explanations, and maybe it's not so bad that they stay here, or, you know, sound familiar? Reasons to not change their behavior, reasons not to take the action they needed to take. And so as today we're experiencing increasing numbers of fires, floods, hurricanes, extreme heat, famine, how many plagues do we need before we stop making excuses and start changing our behavior? All right, now it gets a little more positive. And so I'm personally actually very hopeful and would say confident that there are paths we can take to rapidly reduce climate warming emissions and create an even, and this is the important part, not just stop the problem, but create an even better world for generations to come. But again, it's going to require fundamental, radical, and disruptive, and probably painful change. That is part of the deal. Alex Steffen is an environmental journalist who's been reporting on climate for about 20 years, and he questions the current narrative about how we address climate change. He believes that we are deluding ourselves. We think there's any chance that fixing climate change will then allow us to continue as we have lived before. Just put in some solar panels, you know, buy some electric cars, maybe eat a little bit less meat, and everything's going to be fine again. And so part of the challenge is not just doing, acting, but acting from the understanding that it's going to have to be about making a better world, not just continuing the world that we have. So as he said, I'm just going to read his quote. If we succeed in accelerating change quickly enough, and that's the other piece I want to put out there, we have a very small window, 5 to 7 years, to do this. So if you're sitting going, you know, this is great, my kids will do this, my grandkids will do this, we need you to be doing it, guys. We need everybody to be all in. This is an all-in kind of thing. We have 5 to 7 years. If we succeed in accelerating change quickly enough, we may not reverse the catastrophes that the last 5 decades, a little bit longer, has saddled us with, but we may well snap forward into a global boom of sustainable prosperity and systems ruggedization that not only enables us to be largely successful, but leaves billions of people better off than they are now. So there is a vision here that I subscribe to, that we can actually use this crisis, use this challenge, to make the world a better place. And that's what we're going to be talking about most of the time. But part of it is that we have to move beyond denial or despair, because that's kind of where most people who think about this stuff, you know, bounce back and forth around. There's two. You got two more D's there. You got it. See, he's paying attention. You get it. The best scientists in the world are now saying that as bad as things seem to get, you know, they are going to get worse and happen more frequently, right? It's going to get worse. But if that's where we stop, if we think our only choices are denial and despair, we're not going to act. So the position I choose to take is that, yes, the problem is bad. It's big. It's getting worse. But I want to lead a life, or at least the rest of my life, where taking action I can, taking every action I can to address those worst problems and at the same time develop solutions to make the world a better place, more just, peaceful, healthier, and sustainable for all of God's creation. You might want to take a look at the Holden Village vision and mission. I stole it from there. Okay, that's what Holden's about also, right? Make the world a better, more sustainable, just, healthier place. So let me tell a story that gives me some hope around this. In 2009, I started Terra Verde at my kitchen table, as I said. And for the next 12 months, I drove up and down California looking for school districts who might be interested in putting solar panels and on their schools. And one of the ones that I started working with was Clovis Unified School District in 2009. Clovis Unified School District is the 18th largest school district in California, have about 40,000 students, over 90 school campuses. They serve, it's an interesting district in that they serve about a third of the city of Fresno, which is a very low-income area. But the other two-thirds serves the city of Clovis, which is a very wealthy area. And it's in a community that is very conservative. Let me just put it that way. One of their representatives is Devin Nunez. Anybody know who he is? Who, by the way, just to kind of, this is a side note, who because of, well, we'll say, look, he actually did some very important work on behalf of the environment in 2015. And next door to this district is Kevin McCarthy, represents Kern County, which is just south of here, which is the largest oil producing area in California. And you know who Kevin McCarthy is, obviously, people understand. He's a minority, Republican minority leader, complete sleazebag. Anyway, I didn't say that. So I started working with this school board, right? And they were like, why would we ever, you know, this is a bunch of, you know, hippie, you know, Bay Area, this, that, and the other, right? Nonsense. And I said, well, you know, I've looked at your electricity bills, and I, you know, with my team have come to see that you can actually save, if you just do a little bit of solar, you can save about $2.5 million a year on your electricity bill. Okay? And they were like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. Long story short, it took 2.5 years of going back to the school board, doing more studies, you know, this, that, and the other, having workshops. But eventually, the school board, and this is the meeting where they decided it, also happened to be the meeting where Pablo Sandoval hit 3 home runs against Justin Verlander and the Giants were in the World Series, which made me very happy. And they kept asking me, you know, as I had my phone, how's the World Series going? But they actually voted to put a bond measure on the ballot, meaning taxpayers would pay for this financing, a $25 million bond measure to fund the first set of solar panels. And in fact, the chairman of the Fresno County Tea Party, right, which right now looks like a relatively moderate organization compared to other parts of the Republican Party, because he's also the chair of the Republican Party in Fresno County, led the bond measure effort, to get the voters to tax themselves to put solar panels on their schools. You know, the interesting anecdote is when I first met with him and I had my PowerPoint and I showed all the environmental benefits, he was like, I don't care about it, you know, don't worry about that. Show me the money, right? And that was a big part of my strategy with Terra Verde in the early years, was showing people the money, right? And subsequent to that, they did about 10 megawatts of solar, then we've done another 15 megawatts, we've added batteries. They have the largest solar project of any school district in the state, and they still, you know, vote for Devin Nunes. Right? So the story of hope here is around the fact that you can get stuff done, right? You just have to find around change. And oh, by the way, they have come around in terms of global warming, and they now, you know, their science curriculum talks about climate change. They're doing because they see, you know, we softened them up, right? With they're now saving actually $3.5 million a year because we've added batteries. But that's my story of hope. We can get them to do this. And oh, by the way, once they did it, right? This is a very this is a very conservative district, but also one that had a good reputation in the state for having the excellent facilities at schools. We've done solar now at 60% of the schools in the Central Valley, the most conservative part of California. And again, these are also primarily districts where, you know, over 80-90% of the kids qualify for free reduced lunch, which is the indicator of low income poverty, because that rural part of California is very poor. Story that gives me hope. 10 years later, from that 2009, I was standing in front of Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's sitting right here, Jerry Brown, ex-governors of California, who played a central role, and we'll talk about that later, in the solar revolution in California, celebrating 1 million solar roofs. Meaning, in 2005, not only did the ITC pass, but another key measure is that California, Arnold, led an effort to launched something called the California Solar Initiative, the goal being to have a million solar projects in California. And we reached that in that fall of that year, and it was Clovis Unified School District that hosted the celebration of 1 million solar roofs. So again, reasons for hope. Let's see. Okay, we're going to have another little quick discussion. But this, we'll just do it as a group, okay, because we're running a little bit out of time. Consider the possibility that the climate emergency does, in fact, create opportunities for building a better world. What's one change you would hope to come out of this opportunity in your local community, in the United States, and in the world? What are some of the, if we get beyond just fixing the problem, but actually using this crisis to change the world, for a better, what would be something at each of those levels, right? Local, U.S., global. Just popcorn. Any thoughts?
Racial inequality.
What else?
Stop using drinking water to keep grass growing.
Yeah, I driving up here from the number of trucks you see carrying hay, right, on Highway 5 coming up from California. I just think these are trucks carrying water. It just looks like hay, but it's actually water. Yeah, a lot of it from Imperial County in Southern California where farmers have the rights to just, use water that people need to drink. Yeah. What else?
Where did that water come from, though?
Colorado River.
Mm-hmm. And farther north of here.
Yeah. Montana. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Local food production, like the small farms and
yep.
Dairy.
Well, let's talk about dairy for a second. I know this is a tough issue. For folks.
I'm thinking of more like the family farm.
Yeah, family farm, right. Yeah. Yeah. Dairy, we'll talk later about dairy. Dairy's a problem. Yeah. What else? I'm sorry, healthier diets, yeah. Yeah.
Transportation.
What about transportation?
Get us out of our cars.
Get out of cars. Or at least ICE cars, right? Everybody know what ICE stands for?
No.
Internal combustion engine. That's another acronym you want to hold on to, because we need to get rid of those.
Walkable communities?
Walkable communities.
Better air quality.
Good.
Attention to our forests.
Less materialism.
There we go.
Less war.
Yeah. I mean, let's take one minute around. What do you think the wars of the last 20 years have been about?
Oil,
right? Yeah. And what I mean, what's been going on in Iraq, Syria, whatever. I mean, these climate. They're climate wars.
Is it too big of an ask to find a global communication model? So when these things come up, you've got a way to talk about them on a global basis, and they could be reached further than climate change.
Yep. Well, how did we do on COVID? Global communication.
Local.
Right. And I just want to, I'll just sort of riff for a second. You know, I really think our Earth sent us COVID as a early warning and as a test of what we need to do at a global level, because we're not going to solve climate change. We haven't talked about this, but just because California or the United States reduces its emissions, that's not going to fix things. This is a global effort, and we're not doing so well on the pandemic, and maybe we'll learn some things there, including not just communication, but global problem solving, global decision making, global action. Yeah.
How about a different economic model rather than consumer based?
Okay, here we go. All right. Economic model. Not consumer based. Yeah. And the reason I want not be the end of this conversation. I mean, this is just sort of a fertilizing exercise, because part of taking action to do something is not just about we got to fix the problem. It's like, what's the opportunity, right? What's the positive that we can get out of this? And this is not the be all answer, but this is something that we do need to all start thinking about.
Isn't the gorilla in the room the human population numbers?
Yeah, it is, and what's known as you probably know this term, carrying capacity, right?
Right.
What
the spaceship is too full.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's only too full. It's the distribution of resources. We could do with 20 more people, 20 times the level of a sub-Saharan population than a North American population.
Right.
Right.
Given the resource
not just
usage.
The total
yeah.
number. It's,
yeah.
It's
but I mean, it is, given, here's my problem. I'm not talking about, I'm not sort of coming in on the side of population control at all. I think COVID and other things and climate are going to take care of that, honestly. and it's, we don't have time for population control to fix this, to be honest.
This may require some spiritual changing.
Perhaps
even the religions get together and say, let's not go to hell together.
Part for me is around that, is what I was saying earlier, where we're going with this last piece, which is the one thing that I think most religions have in common is the notion that we are all connected. We are all part of God's creation, right? We are not separate. And when we think of ourselves as separate is when we get into trouble. And this crisis is one, it's really clear. If we think of ourselves as separate, we're not going to survive it. So to the extent that this crisis forces us to see our connections, spiritually and otherwise, maybe we'll have a better world in that regard. And we're forced into it. Yeah. So let me. I don't want to keep you past five. So I got two more pages that I really want to go through, and then we'll wrap up for today. We can do this. I really am confident we can do this. Think about it this way. Here you got your Tesla and you got your horse, you got your iPhone, you got your analog phone. Anybody here too young to know what this is? And you've got your fossil fuel plant, and actually that's a concentrating solar power plant, which doesn't really work very well, but that's the only picture I can find. Photovoltaics, much better. Horses were the dominant mode of transportation for millennia, right? Landline phones and analog cameras were in place for over a century and a half. And there were huge regulatory, political, and cognitive and emotional barriers to anything else other than those, right? Many of us remember when AT&T was the only phone company, right? But cars, smartphones, digital cameras, and as we'll see, clean energy, all achieved mass adoption within 10 to 15 years, right? It's like all of a sudden, they were gone and the new thing was here. So I think we can do this. And there's an organization run by a guy named Tony Seba called Rethink X. And the way he puts it is, if the world recognizes this dramatic shift and ends protection, this is a key point, one of the strategies we have to look at, ends protection for incumbent destructive industries, as well as invest strategically in the most optimal sectors and technologies, humanity will be able to eliminate 90% of global carbon emissions within the next 15 years. He released this study this spring. And reach net zero by 2040, or even well before 2035. This is faster than most conventional analysts, including the IPCC, believe, and it will save trillions of dollars in the process and usher in a new area of post-carbon prosperity. So why do we listen to Tony Seba? We listen to Tony Seba because he is a engineer futurist who, his latest prediction in 2008 is that by 2008, I was putting solar projects in where the panels cost about $3.50 a watt. You don't have to know what that means, but think of that number, $3.60. In that year, he predicted that, based on his analysis of trends, technology, finance, sociopolitical stuff, that by 2020, solar panels would be at 35 cents a watt. And he was right. He was right on target. And he's put together very sophisticated models, supercomputer based, blah, 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 where he truly believes we can eliminate 90% of our emissions. But we got to do these two very important things. We got to stop subsidizing the bad stuff, and we got to invest in the good stuff. The budget reconciliation bill that you probably have heard about, that's like this week and next week, and many of you are senators. Mr. Tester is a key player in this, so keep him on the prize. If that goes through, that's a beginning piece. It's not in any way enough, but it's a beginning piece of that, both disinvestment in harmful stuff and investment in good stuff that we need. So we actually have, I mean, it's amazing if you think about where we were a year ago, that we actually have a policy proposal on the table that could do this. Right, could do what we're talking about. And last but not least, Greta Thunberg. At age 15, a young 15-year-old girl stood at the steps of the Swedish Parliament on Friday afternoons challenging her government to take action on climate. And within a few months, just a few months, millions of children around the world took up her challenge. She said, "The one thing we need more than hope is action. Once we start to act, hope will be everywhere. Right? Really important message. So the remainder of our sessions will be addressing the many ways, big and small, we can and must take action and hopefully therefore build hope versus denial and despair and all those other bad deeds. Thank you.